Why don't you turn with me to the book of Ruth, chapter 2. Ruth, it's the 8th book in the Old Testament. Joshua, Judges, then Ruth. And we've got a lot to cover and not all that much time, so I'm going to get right into it. We started our series in Ruth last week, looked at chapter 1. Now, Ruth is this story that is set in the time of the Judges, which was a time in Israel's history where there was a lot of backsliding and disobedience on the part of the Israelites, and it's really a dark time in their history, and Ruth is this story set right during that time that really is this ray of hope, this ray of light in the midst of a dark time. And you have these three main characters who exhibit what faithfulness looks like at a time when most of Israel was being unfaithful. So just as a reminder, we have, who are our three main characters in this story? Ruth, Naomi, her mother-in-law, and Boaz, who we will be introduced to today. Yes, and pop quiz, what is the theme of Ruth? As we talked about it yesterday, and give you a little clue, you have to know Hebrew to know the answer to this question. What's the theme? Nice, good gutturals. I heard some in there. Yeah, Hesed, H-E-S-E-D. It's a Hebrew word, and it really captures well the theme of Ruth. So if you weren't here last week, you get caught up in one word, Hesed. Hesed is a word that's sometimes translated loyal love or steadfast love, faithfulness, loving kindness. Hesed is that love and commitment that goes beyond the call of duty, that defies expectations of what we'd expect someone to do. It's that love and commitment that goes beyond. Hesed is not a love that you feel or think about so much, but hesed is something you do. It's steadfast love in action, and that's what I'm calling this series, is steadfast love in action. And in Ruth, we don't so much get a definition of hesed, we get pictures of hesed, what hesed looks like in everyday life. Most importantly, we get a picture of God's hesed, his love and his commitment to his people through thick and thin, through hard times, through good times. We see God's hesed being played out. And then secondly, we also see pictures of human hesed, as we see people like Ruth and Boaz and their love and commitment to Naomi, this woman who is hurting. So really inspiring story in the midst of a dark time in Israel's history. And I was thinking about that this week. I thought, you know, we need two kinds of stories in our lives. We need stories that comfort, but we also need stories that inspire. And a lot of the Old Testament stories, I think, are stories that comfort, because there are these stories of these people who are really messed up. These, you know, people that God chooses that make all sorts of bad decisions. You've got Abraham's family, guys like Jacob, and then the Israelites and their kind of wanderings in the wilderness, and these people who just live these broken, messed up lives. And I think that's really comforting, because you're like, oh, these people are as bad as I am. And yet God remained faithful through thick and thin to them, and that's really comforting. We need those comforting stories. But we also need stories to inspire. We need stories of people who got it right, who are maybe a little ahead of us in terms of their love and commitment and faithfulness to one another. And that's what we get in the book of Ruth, these great examples of what living out a life of chesed can look like. So we're meant to be inspired by this little story, I believe. So just to catch you up, just to remind you, last week, this story starts with a series of tragedies in Naomi's life. Okay, Naomi is this woman who was married to this man named Elimelech, and they had two sons. They lived in Israel, and the first thing that happened was there was a famine, and in the midst of the famine, they left their home and went to a foreign land in Moab, and their two sons married two Moabite women, foreign women of a different religious background. And then the unthinkable happened in Moab. First, Naomi's husband died, and then in the course of 10 years, both of her sons died. And she was left alone in this foreign land with these two foreign daughters-in-law. And if you look at the end of chapter 1, you see her response of grief to these situations. Look at verse 20 in chapter 1. She ends this passage by saying, "Don't call me Naomi, which means pleasant, anymore." She says, "Call me Mara," which means bitter. So I got a text from Mark the other day, sorry, when the Lakers lost the game. And the text just said, "Don't call me Mark, call me Mara." And it was beautiful. So that's the level of depression that Naomi's going through this time. That wasn't planned. So you have this woman who has gone, whose life has gone from pleasant to bitter, which is what Mara means. She says, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. So from pleasant to bitter, from fullness to emptiness. And yet what we saw is that in her pain and in her depression, she couldn't see. She didn't see some of the things that God was doing, because the truth was she didn't come back to Israel empty, because God had given her Ruth, this amazing daughter-in-law who made this commitment to her, and we're going to see that commitment start to be played out in chapter 2. So today we find these two women back in Israel, these two widows trying to figure out how to survive on their own without men in their lives. And the theme for this morning is again Chesed, but it's going to be especially how does Chesed deal with power? Okay, how does Chesed deal with being in a position of power, and how does Chesed deal with being in a position of powerlessness? And we all find ourselves in our lives in various situations where we either feel like we have power or we're in a place of powerlessness. We all have different roles, different relational roles. Maybe you have your work life, you have your home life, you have situations in your life where you either feel like you have power in that situation or you're in a place of powerlessness in that. And of course, we all like to be in places of power. We're not all power-hungry people, but we all like to feel like we're in control of what's going on, right? That we have a sense of control, we have the resources to provide for ourselves, to make changes in the situation, and that makes us feel secure. And we don't like being in situations of powerlessness, where we feel out of control, like there are things out of our control that we can't do anything about, that we feel vulnerable, we feel very insecure in those situations. Well, we're going to look at how does Chesed respond to those situations of power. And I'll just give you the sum of what I want to say this morning is this, that in those places of powerlessness in our lives, we have the opportunity, that those places provide us with a unique opportunity to go to God and to find shelter and security in His care. And in those places of power, where we have control and resource in our lives, those provide us with a unique opportunity to be like God. That is to reflect His faithfulness and His care to people who don't have power. So that's what we're going to see as we read this story this morning. So I'm going to kind of just read through the story and make comments along the way, and then we'll step back at the end and make some reflections. So just before I start, one last thing. So let's just acknowledge that we find these two women at the beginning of this chapter in a place of powerlessness, okay? They are two widows with no men in their lives, and one of them is a foreigner living in Israel. The Hebrew word for widow comes from a root word that means unable to speak. And, essentially the widow was the silent one in that culture. Here's how one commentator says it. It's a definition, silent one, that exposes a frightening vulnerability and a nightmarish powerlessness. Without a father, husband, son, or other male relative to speak and act in her defense, a woman had no voice, no legal rights, and no recourse against injustice. So you find these two women, and they're in a place of powerlessness. And then in verse 1, we get introduced to one of the heroes of the story. Take a look, verse 1, chapter 2. Now Naomi had a relative on her husband's side from the clan of Elimelech, a man of standing whose name was Boaz. And here's one of our heroes of the story. He's described as a man of standing in the NIV. King James translates that, a mighty man of wealth. The New Living translates it, a wealthy and influential man. It's a word that captures wealth, reputation, competence, ability, valor. It's a man of significance and standing. And if you think about the power dynamics issue, you couldn't have two more opposite people on opposite sides of the power spectrum. You have these two widows who are powerless, and then you have this man of standing who has resource, power, ability. Here's a man who can, if he wants to, help these women in their powerless situation. And the narrator introduces him right up front, but of course, Ruth and Naomi don't know about him yet, and that's part of the fun of the story, is we know more than Ruth does as the story goes on. All right, verse 2. And Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, "Let me go to the fields and pick up the leftover grain behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor." Naomi said to her, "Go ahead, my daughter." So she went out and began to glean in the fields behind the harvesters. As it turned out, she found herself working in a field belonging to Boaz, who was from the clan of Elimelech. So you've got these two women. Chances are they're experiencing some level of depression. It's probably hard to get up and go. And so I get a sense of Naomi as someone who's just stuck in her grief and is really unable to act. And so you see Ruth, she's made this commitment to her mother-in-law. So she takes the initiative and she says, "You know what? I'm going to go out into the fields and I'm going to glean. Is that all right with you?" And Naomi says, "Go ahead, daughter." So she's going to go glean in the fields. Let me give you a little brief background on gleaning fields in ancient culture, in case you haven't done a lot of that lately. So you know you've got these landowners who they've got these fields where they've got grain, and here's how the harvesting works. They have some men who work for them, and they'll come along. You've got all this standing grain. The men come along, and they grab a handful and then take a sickle to it and cut it off at the roots and then lay it down in a bunch. And then you have some female workers who work for the landowner who come along, and they bundle this up. They bind it up, and then they take it to the threshing floor, and they'll thresh it however you thresh grain. That's how they clear their fields. And then gleaners were beggars. They're the poor, they're the widow, they're the orphan, they're the foreigner. They're begging. They're people who don't have a job. And so what they do is they'll come through the fields after that process has taken place, and there may still be some standing grain left that they can pull out from the roots, or maybe there's a little bit left on the ground, and they'll pick it up, and they'll that's what they'll take, and they'll try to thresh it themselves, and that's what they try to bring home at the end of the day. It's basically, they're trying to get the leftovers of what's left behind. And, it's a little easy to romanticize gleaning. You picture this person kind of in a beautiful countryside place and doing this harvesting thing. But there's nothing romantic about gleaning at all, okay? This is begging. This is trying to get the scraps. And it's hard work. It's back-breaking work in the heat of the day. There's also competition between gleaners, right? You guys are all fighting for the scraps. So sometimes you might go out to the field, you may come home at the end of the day with not enough to eat because there's other people that are, you're all fending for this small amount of stuff. As a woman, you are totally vulnerable in that time. You've got men out there, you're out in the open field, you're out far away from the city, and most of those workers probably aren't highly refined gentlemen. So you've got a situation where you're putting yourself in danger. So very, very vulnerable, very powerless situation. But we have this God who has a heart for the powerless, has a heart for the widow and the orphan. And so he gave Israel certain laws to benefit those beggars who were gleaners. I want to show you just a couple laws that we get. Here's Leviticus 19. God says this to Israel. "When you reap the harvest of your land, do not reap to the very edges of your field or gather the gleanings of your harvest. Do not go over your vineyard a second time or pick up the grapes that have fallen. Leave them for the poor and the alien. I am the Lord your God." So basically saying, leave the corners and don't go over things a second time so that there's some left over. Deuteronomy passage, "When you are harvesting in your field and you overlook a sheaf, do not go back to get it. Leave it for the alien, the fatherless, and the widow, so that the Lord your God may bless you in all the work of your hands." So you've got this God who is trying to tell people, leave space in your fields for these beggars, essentially. But you can imagine at that time, especially in the time of the judges, that there are a lot of landowners that weren't particularly interested in obeying that law. These are guys, these are businessmen, they're going to want to, get as much profit as they can, so they're going to squeeze out as much as they can from their land. So if you're a gleaner, there's always the danger that you might be going into the fields of a landowner who's not really interested in you being there, okay? So just add that to the list. All right, so Ruth says, "Let me go glean in the fields behind anyone in whose eyes I find favor," meaning there may be some people in whose eyes I'm not going to find favor. So she goes out. And she just so happens, you know, just so happens to end up in Boaz's field. She doesn't know Boaz at this time, but God is directing this process. Verse 4, and wouldn't you know it, just then, Boaz arrived from Bethlehem and greeted the harvesters. The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you, they called back. So we've got Boaz. We know he's a man of standing, and now we see he is a man of the Lord. We see this is a guy whose faith comes out in who he is, even in his business. He's out there, and he's not compartmentalizing his faith, okay? We would say today he's not a Sunday morning Christian. This is a guy who lives out his faith in the day-to-day. I guess we would say he wasn't a Saturday morning Jew, right? That's how that would work in the Old Testament. But you get the point. So this man of God whose life is characterized by his faith in the Lord. Verse 5, Boaz asked the foreman of his harvesters, whose young woman is that? And let me suggest that this is not a romantic, like, ooh, who's that? You know, who's that hottie over there? I don't think that's what's going on. He's coming to check in on his fields, and he's seeing someone he hasn't seen before, and he says, whose is that? What community does that woman beggar over there belong to? Verse 6, the foreman replied, she is the Moabitess who came back from Moab with Naomi. She said, please let me glean and gather among the sheaves behind the harvesters. She went into the field and has worked steadily from morning till now, except for a short rest in the shelter. So you get a picture of Ruth, that she's come and she's asked politely to be able to glean in this field, and you see that she's working hard. She's been working all day except for a short rest. Listen to Boaz's response, verse 8. These are words of Hesed. So Boaz said to Ruth, my daughter, listen to me. Don't go and glean in another field, and don't go away from here. Stay here with my servant girls. Watch the field where the men are harvesting, and follow along after the girls. I have told the men not to touch you. And whenever you are thirsty, go and get a drink from the water jars the men have filled. So notice, he's not just saying, hey, it's okay if you glean in my fields. I'm fine with that, which would be the obedient, faithful response. But he goes beyond that. He says, I don't want you to go into any other fields. You stay in my fields. You can glean in my fields. And he offers to provide for her, and he offers to protect her. He says, I've told all my men not to harm you. And he's also said, the water that I give my workers, I want you to draw from that water. You can have all of that too. So these words of commitment and care and provision. And look at Ruth's response, this great response of humility. Verse 10, at this she bowed down with her face to the ground. She exclaimed, why have I found such favor in your eyes that you notice me, a foreigner? It's like, I'm a foreigner, I'm a nobody. Why have you noticed me? And she has found favor in someone's eyes. That was her hope at the beginning. Verse 11, we find out that Boaz has heard about her before. Boaz replied, I've been told all about what you have done for your mother-in-law since the death of your husband. How you left your father and mother and your homeland and came to live with a people you did not know before. May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. I love this verse 11, really this, again, describing really a very Abrahamic-like response that Ruth gave to leaving her homeland, leaving everything that she knew to go to Israel, to choose Israel's God, and to stay committed to Naomi. And Boaz makes this great statement in verse 12, may God reward you, the God under whose wings you have come to take refuge. I want to come back to that verse. I think it's key in this passage. Verse 13, again, very gracious, humble response from Ruth. May I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, she said. You have given me comfort and have spoken kindly to your servant, though I do not have the standing of one of your servant girls. She's like, I'm a foreigner. I don't even have the standing of a servant girl, and yet you have noticed me. You've cared for me. Thank you for that. Verse 14, at mealtime, Boaz said to her, come over here. Have some bread and dip it in the wine vinegar. When she sat down with the harvesters, he offered her some roasted grain. She ate all she wanted and had some left over. So you got to remember, Ruth is starving at this point, right? She is begging for food. And so Boaz invites her over to his table, has some bread and some, you know, balsamic vinegar and, you know, all this fun stuff. And she's very hungry. So he gives her food. And what I want us to see in this is the remarkable power differential that you have, the difference in power that you have between these two people in this moment, and they're sharing a meal together. And most of you know that in ancient cultures, to share a meal was this real expression of community and fellowship and equality and intimacy. And you've got Boaz, who is inviting this foreign widow beggar into fellowship with him and offering her food. And I was trying to come up with a modern example of what this would feel like to the people who are watching it. So here's my best shot. You know, let's say you own a real estate company, okay? You've got a large company and you're owner of it. Let's say you guys build residential neighborhoods, okay? And you're the boss man and you're the guy. You wear a suit and you work behind a desk. And your company's doing a new development of homes. So you go out to the site one day, and you've got your general contractors, and they're working under you, and they're kind of running things, and they've got their workers under them, some who are kind of high up and some who are low, and they're all doing this stuff, and you're out there in your suit, and they're working. And then that day, they needed a few extra guys, so they went to a street corner, and they hired some foreign day laborers from south of the border, okay? These guys that they've hired, and they've come in, and they're the guys digging the ditches and sweeping while other guys are building stuff. And you come in, and you've got your suit, and you see those day laborers working on your site, okay? That would be close to the power differential that would be felt. So just imagine, you know, that person inviting one of those guys over and to have lunch together and be, you know, providing for them. That gives you a sense of maybe what that would feel like. And it's this beautiful picture, them eating together, beautiful picture of God's values and how God wants his kingdom to be lived out. So he gives her food. Verse 15, as she got up to glean, Boaz gave orders to his men. I love this. Even if she gathers among the sheaves, don't embarrass her. Rather, pull out some stalks for her from the bundles and leave them for her to pick up, and don't rebuke her. Okay, there's some question among scholars about where exactly Ruth is gleaning throughout this thing. But what's clear here is Boaz is saying, he's giving her special privileges, basically. And he's saying, I want you to let her glean right among your process. She doesn't have to wait for you to finish this, but she can glean right among there. And even guys and gals, I want you to, why don't you just leave some, you know, as you're cutting stuff up, why don't you just accidentally leave some behind for her, basically. Okay, so he's really going above and beyond to provide for Ruth. So verse 17, so Ruth gleaned in the field until evening. She works a hard full day. Then she threshed the barley she had gathered, and it amounted to about an ephah. So she takes it to the threshing floor. She, however you thresh, she does that, and she's got an ephah, which is a lot. Okay, that doesn't matter how much, but she's got a lot of food that she's coming home with. So that's the scene I want to focus on. And let's just read through the second scene just to finish this off. But the second scene through the rest of the chapter, just this beautiful picture of her coming home to Naomi. And you've got this woman who's been under such grief and despair. And you see her hope revived as Ruth comes home with all this food. Verse 18, she carried it back to town, and her mother-in-law saw how much she had gathered. Ruth also brought out and gave her what she had left over after she had eaten enough. Her mother-in-law asked her, where did you glean today? Where did you work? Blessed be the man who took notice of you. Then Ruth told her mother-in-law about the one at whose place she had been working. The name of the man I worked with today is Boaz, she said. The Lord bless him, Naomi said to her daughter-in-law. He has not stopped showing his, guess which word? Hesed, yes, kindness, my translation. He has not stopped showing his kindness to the living and the dead. She added, that man is our close relative. He is one of our kinsmen redeemers. So Naomi, you see her hope revived, and you realize even in her grief, she hadn't abandoned the Lord, right? Here, I mean, the Lord's name is on her lips quickly. She's saying, the Lord bless this man. He's showing kindness to us. It's hard to know, does she mean the Lord is showing Hesed or is Boaz showing Hesed? Scholars don't really know. Either way, it works fine. And then she gives us this point that he is one of our kinsmen redeemers, and we'll talk about that next week. But it's essentially a relative who has an obligation to care for his relatives who are in need. And so Naomi hears that, and she's filled with hope. Here's a man who can do something about our situation. Verse 21, then Ruth the Moabitess said, he even said to me, stay with my workers until they finish harvesting all my grain. Naomi said to Ruth, her daughter-in-law, "It will be good for you, my daughter, to go with his girls, because in someone else's field, you might be harmed." So Ruth stayed close to the servant girls of Boaz to glean until the barley and the wheat harvest were finished, and she lived with her mother-in-law. So that's the passage. Great pictures of chesed, yeah? Not a definition, but these examples of what faithfulness and love looks like in everyday life. And I want us to reflect for about 10 minutes or so, the rest of our time, on the power, as I said at the beginning, the power dynamics and how what chesed does with power, how chesed handles power, and how chesed handles powerlessness. And so I want us to look at these two characters, Ruth and Boaz, who are on complete opposite sides of the power spectrum, but they both lived very faithfully given where they were in that spectrum. So let's first consider Ruth together, okay? This position of powerlessness, this silent one, this foreigner who, as she says, doesn't even have the standing of one of Boaz's servant girls. What I see her doing is acting very faithfully in the midst of powerlessness. And the first thing that we notice is in the midst of powerlessness, she doesn't give up, right? She doesn't just sit back and wait for things to happen. She acts. She acts decisively. She acts creatively. That's what we see. Verse 2, she takes the initiative with her mother-in-law. She says, "I'm going out into the fields. I'm going to work. I'm going to try to provide for us in the fields." She does that. She puts herself in a risky and a very vulnerable place in going to the fields, right? And then you see a very hard worker. She works all day long. She's working hard. And yet all of this with this posture of humility and gratitude. I mean, I look at the way she responds to Boaz. There's no sense of entitlement from her. There's no sort of victim mentality for her. It's very much grateful, humble, and grateful for what she receives. So she acts in the midst of powerlessness. She does what she can. But there's something deeper that I think that she does that is even more important for us to recognize here. And I want to go back to verse 12. You guys still with me? You got another 10 minutes in you? Okay, cool. Verse 12, I really think this is one of the keys to this chapter. And this is what she's doing. She's acting, but on a deeper level, this is what she does with her powerlessness. This is Boaz again. "May the Lord repay you for what you have done. May you be richly rewarded by the Lord, the God of Israel." And here it is. "Under whose wings you have come to take refuge." Boaz is saying, you Ruth, you've in your powerlessness, you've come to take refuge under God's wings. And the image, of course, is God as this like mighty eagle, we'll say. And Ruth is this little eaglet. She's this, you know, vulnerable, fragile little bird, and yet she has come to under God's wings for provision and protection. And she did that essentially when she chose to leave Moab and go to Israel. That decision wasn't just a decision for Naomi. That was a decision for God to come under his wings for protection. And when you think about it, from a human perspective, remaining in Moab would have been the logical thing to do for her, right? I mean, she has family there. It's her homeland. She's comfortable there. There's probably much better connections, opportunities for her to become married to someone again. From a human perspective, that was the safe bet. But we know that ultimately, she can never be safer than when she comes to find refuge under God's wings. And so she takes what, from a human perspective, is this great risk, but ultimately, she has come under God's wings for protection. John Piper puts it this way: "Ruth has sought refuge under God's wings. She has counted his protection better than all others. She has set her heart on God for hope and joy. And when a person does that, God's honor is at stake, and he will be merciful." I like that. I think that's what God is looking for, as people in their powerlessness to come to him, to find refuge, to find protection under the shadow of his wings. And when people do that, he responds. And that's what we see in this chapter. We see God responding. Verse 3 says, she happened to find herself in Boaz's fields, but we know that she didn't just happen to find herself there. All along, God's hidden providence was working, bringing it about that she ended up in Boaz's fields, even if she didn't know it. You've got God, this great eagle, who is protecting the little eaglet. So my first question to you this morning is, where in your life are you in a place where you feel powerless? What's a situation where you don't feel like you have control, where there's a sense of vulnerability and insecurity? It may be work for you. It may be some relational dynamic that you're in the midst of, or maybe it's just a very specific situation right now. Many of you, financially, that's certainly the case right now, as there are things that are happening that feel out of your control. Well, I want to suggest this morning, based off of this passage, that it's in those places of powerlessness, those places provide us with a unique opportunity to go to God to find shelter and protection. Those provide us with a unique opportunity to do that. And of course, we have to continue to act like Ruth did, to act faithfully, to act creatively, to do what we can. And clearly we see that. But underneath that all, it's doing that in this posture of dependence and prayer, as Mark said earlier, and acknowledging that God is the one who will ultimately provide. So where are you in that place of powerlessness? Where can you say, you know what, God, I'm coming to you in this area of my life. Before I rely on man, before I rely on my own abilities, my own resources, I'm coming to you for this. And I'm gonna count on you. I'm gonna depend on you to provide. As I was thinking about that this week, I thought there's one area in all of our lives that we have in common where we are powerless. And that is in our standing before God. We're all powerless in that area, in our standing before God. And I've been reading Jeremiah lately, and you read the prophets, it's thick reading, it's heavy going, and you're reading about the disobedience of Israel at the time and God's judgment on them, and it's pretty gnarly, and I was feeling that this week. And what I was feeling was, we have all the same bad stuff that they had. You know, I mean, there's greed and idolatry and immorality. I'm like, that's us. And what's to keep God from bringing his judgment on us? And I felt that. And my first human response was, we've got to get our act together. And not, maybe I'm just, you know, this is me feeling my own sins. I don't want to project that on you guys. But my human response, I really felt that. I was like, we got to get our act together. And but as I thought about it, I thought, no. No, what we need to do is we need to seek shelter under the wings of Jesus Christ. That's what we need to do. Because that's the reason God's not going to judge us in the same way. Because we have sought shelter under the wings of Jesus. We've put our faith in him and what he did for us on the cross. That he's paid the penalty that we deserve. That he's taken on the judgment and wrath that we deserve. And so what we need to do is simply seek shelter under the shadow of the cross. But the natural human responses, I've got to do something. I've got to get my act together. And I believe that God is seeking people not who are going to say, I can be good enough, I'm going to get my act together, but people who are willing to seek shelter under the wings of his son. And so that's a place where we are all powerless, where we can seek shelter together. So where is it that you need to go to God for shelter? And then secondly and finally, I want to take a look at Boaz, who's on the opposite side of the spectrum in a position of power. And realistically, we have a lot more Boazes in this room than Ruths, right? I mean, socioeconomically and influence and all, from a human perspective, we are Boazes generally, not Ruths. Notice what Boaz does with his power throughout this chapter. I love that he, in verse 5, he notices Ruth. He's on the lookout and he sees her and he says, who is that? He's paying attention. He doesn't have to wait for her to come to him. He notices someone in need, and he says, who is that woman? And then, of course, he provides for her. He provides her with protection. And what I realized this week is he provides her not just with provision and protection, but with dignity, doesn't he? I mean, he gives her dignity, both in the way that he invites her to lunch as an equal person, gives her that dignity of sharing lunch with them, but also, and this is what our Ruth mentioned in our staff study this week, he doesn't enable Ruth, does he? He doesn't just give her a handout, actually. He could have just dumped a bunch of food on her and said, go home. He allows her to work the whole day. I mean, he gives her the ability to faithfully provide for her mother-in-law and to come home and say, I worked all day for you and here's what I've given. And I think he gives her dignity in that. So in sum, what he does is, what does he do with his power? He uses his power. He uses his influence on behalf of someone who doesn't have power and influence. And in doing that, he reflects the heart of our God. I want to show you another passage. Isaiah 57, this is the Lord. Look at God's heart here. This is what the high and lofty one says. He who lives forever, whose name is holy. I live in a high and holy place, but also with him who is contrite and lowly in spirit, to revive the spirit of the lowly and to revive the heart of the contrite. That's who our God is. He is this high and lofty God, but who also lives with those who are lowly and contrite. And the question for those in power is this: will we reflect God's heart for the powerless? And in Boaz's case, the answer is yes. And that's what you see. You see a guy who is reflecting God's heart to Ruth. He's a living picture of God's chesed to Ruth. And there's a really cool way that the narrator kind of communicates that. In verse 12, you know how he talks about Ruth finding shelter under the wings of God? In chapter 3, Ruth is going to come to Boaz on the threshing floor. This is a kind of a racy scene that we get to next week. And she's going to say, spread your garment over me. And the word for garment is the same word as the word for wing in chapter 2. And so what you have is this picture of Ruth coming under the wings of God, but ultimately she's going to come under the wings of Boaz. And he is going to be basically a living picture of God's faithfulness to Ruth. He's going to be the way that God protects Ruth. So he gets to play this great role of reflecting God's chesed to Ruth. So as I said, those places of powerlessness offer us a unique opportunity to run to God and seek shelter. Those places of power and influence in our lives offer us a unique opportunity to be like God, meaning to reflect his provision and his heart for those who don't have power, to use our resources for their sake. And it's an issue of stewardship. How are we going to steward the resources, the influence, the power, the stuff that we have, and use it on behalf of those who don't, whether that's financial or influence or whatever? So I want you to consider two situations of power today. First is this. Consider a specific situation in your life right now where you're in a place of influence and you know of someone who's in a place of relative powerlessness. Okay, I want you to consider, who are the Ruths in your life right now? Is there someone who is in a vulnerable, just difficult place? How can you use what you have, your influence, your resources, your health, whatever, to reach out and be a picture of God's faithfulness to them? It might be a specific situation. And then the second question is this. Maybe it's not a specific situation, but maybe it's just the daily roles in relationships that you're in. Okay, we all have different relationships of power. It might be as a boss versus an employee, or maybe it's your marriage, or maybe it's as a parent with your children. But we all play in these different ways, these different roles. For those places where we have power and influence in those roles, how can we, again, reflect God's heart on a daily basis to use that power and influence on behalf of those, to serve those who don't have that? I want you to turn to Ephesians 5, and I will end with this. Ephesians 5, just give you an example of this. Again, this is, how do we play out the power, how does chesed play out this issue of power in daily relationships? So here's a passage where Paul just talks about the daily relationships of the time between wives and husbands, between slaves and masters, between parents and children. I want to show you that the one between wives and husbands captures it best. Paul's speaking into a culture where the power differential between husband and wife was way more radical than it is today, which makes what he says even more radical, okay? Men have all the power, women do not. And it's in that context that Paul says, first, this is not the part I want to talk about. First, he says, wives, submit to your husbands as to the Lord. Okay, he's calling for this posture, much like the posture that Ruth had with Boaz, this posture of humility and respect. But I want to get to the one who has power. Look at how he talks to those who have power in the relationship. Verse 25, husbands, love your wives just as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her to make her holy, cleansing her by the washing with water through the word, and to present her to himself as a radiant church without stain or wrinkle or any other blemish, but holy and blameless. In this same way, husbands ought to love their wives as their own bodies. Paul's saying, husbands, you have the power in this relationship. You have the authority in this relationship. How are you going to live that out? What does chesed look like in that context? I want you to live out your leadership and your authority the same way Jesus Christ did. Well, how did he do that? Well, he served. He gave himself up for the church. So husbands, I want you to use your strength. I want you to use your authority and consider how can I put all of this strength and authority into service for my wife? How can I build her up? How can I grow her spiritually as Christ did, you know, without spot or wrinkle? It's a pretty radical concept of how we use power and authority. So that works in marriage. It also works in our businesses. How do we go about faithfully stewarding our power and authority in order to serve those who have no power? What a privilege that is. Isn't that amazing? To be able to reflect God's character to those in need. I mean, it's an amazing privilege. So I close. Where are you in a place of powerlessness? Well, that offers you a unique opportunity to run to God and to find shelter under his wings. And where are you in a place of power? That offers you a unique opportunity to be faithful, to serve those without. Let's pray. Well, Father, we thank you again for this picture of chesed. Most importantly, we thank you that you are a God who, though you are high and exalted, you dwell with us lowly folk. And that you are God who longs for us to find shelter under your wings. And most importantly, who has provided your son so that we can find shelter under his wings and escape judgment. I pray as we experience vulnerability and powerlessness, insecurity, that we would take all that to you and trust you with it. And as we experience power and control and influence, that we would use that in such a way that we are reflecting who you are to the world. Pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.